listeners and the reporters and producers, we put these newscasts together. We determined that we need more time to dive deeper into some of the stories. So, starting today, the new format will include a look at headlines from around the state from the past week, and then in-depth stories, some of which will be followed by a question and answer segment to provide you with even more information.
I'm Gracie J.
First off, let's catch you up on the week's headlines, and there are a lot of them, as Minnesota is suddenly thrust not just into the nation's spotlight, but the world's headlines.
An Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent, or ICE, shot and killed a 37-year-old woman in Minneapolis. ICE called their action self-defense in response to what they called an act of domestic terrorism, the woman driving her car into an agent. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey responded by saying the federal government is trying to spin the narrative, saying the agent was recklessly using power, resulting in someone dying. Mayor Frey went on to say that ICE is causing chaos and demanded that federal agents leave the state immediately. He also called on residents to respond through legal civil channels, saying resorting to violence and riots is exactly what the federal government is trying to provoke to justify a stronger presence here. We'll have much more on this story next week.
Governor Tim Walz announced he is dropping out of the race for governor and will not seek a historic third term for the state's top office.
I came to the conclusion that I can't give a political campaign my all. Every minute that I spend defending my own political interest would be a minute I can't spend defending the people of Minnesota against the criminals who prey on our generosity and the cynics who want to prey on our differences. So I've decided to step out of this race.
While Governor Walz is not running for another term, despite calls from Republicans for his resignation, he says instead of focusing on an election, he'll be focusing on Minnesota.
I'm not going anywhere, and you can make all your requests for me to resign over my dead body.
The Department of Homeland Security has launched the largest immigration crackdown in the nation's history right here in Minnesota. The White House says around 2,000 federal agents will be on the streets of Minnesota. Todd Lyons, the acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, also known as ICE, says the agents are looking for fraud, human trafficking, and violent criminals. He says Minnesota laws and city ordinances designed to protect immigrants end up protecting criminals.
But one thing we should really note, too, is the fact that states like Minnesota that have a strong sanctuary city policy and sanctuary protections, that's just a magnet that brings that criminal element that can hide in plain sight.
ICE has already made more than 1,000 arrests in Minnesota. The White House and other federal agencies are pointing to what they are calling widespread fraud as the justification for sending thousands of federal agents to our state. Fraud, they say, social media influencer Nick Shirley brought to the world's attention in a 42-minute online video in which he appears to knock on the doors of daycare centers he says are scamming the state and federal government out of millions of dollars.
Can I check out daycare center?
No! He's a liar. I'm the owner.
While Shirley's video alleging fraud has attracted more than 130 million views, there's been little national attention to the state of Minnesota's follow-up investigation. The Minnesota Department of Children, Youth, and Families conducted on-site compliance checks on the 9 child care facilities referenced in Shirley's video and found all but one were operating as expected. The exception was one that had not yet opened for the day when the inspectors arrived. That's how some protesters are trying to force ICE agents out of our state. They've resorted to playing loud music outside of the hotels where agents are staying. Controversy surrounding ICE agents staying at Minnesota hotels came to a head in Lakeville, just south of the metro, recently when the Hampton Inn there refused to allow ICE agents to rent rooms. The Department of Homeland Security took to social media to accuse the Hilton chain of discrimination. Hilton released a statement to North Star Stories stating the Hampton Inn in Lakeville is independently owned and is no longer affiliated with Hilton. The assassination of the former Speaker of the Minnesota House of Representatives earlier this year is putting our state back in the nation's spotlight again. President Trump recently posted a video on Truth Social, a social media platform, claiming without any proof to back it up that former Speaker Hortman was killed because she was the only Democrat to vote against a bill providing health care for undocumented immigrants. Hortman's son released a statement asking the president to remove the conspiracy theory video and apologize to the family for posting misinformation that dishonors his mother's memory. Governor Walz had even harsher words about the post.
For those legislators who went and shed crocodile tears at her funeral, shame on you. Shame on you. Her children are asking you to do one thing in her name. It's to tell the president to stop doing this. That shouldn't be that difficult.
In other news, the Homestead County Sheriff says he will not seek a fourth term. Homestead County is home to Rochester in southern Minnesota. Sheriff Kevin Torgerson says it's been an absolute pleasure and honor to serve the citizens of Homestead County since he arrived there in 1986. Torgerson has been the sheriff since 2014. His term will end in January of 2027. In today's main story, the U.S. recently invaded Venezuela and captured the nation's president and his wife. President Trump says it was necessary to stop illegal drugs from entering the U.S. Critics say the president is using drugs as an excuse to take over Venezuela's oil supply. North Star Stories director of news Victor Palomino talks with Minnesotans about the decision to capture the leader of another nation and what it means for different communities within our state.
Late last night and early today, at my direction, the United States Armed Forces conducted an extraordinary military operation in the capital of Venezuela.
That's President Trump announcing the operation that led to the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife. The operation sparked strong reactions around the world. Here in Minnesota, opinions vary greatly.
It was incredible. I remember it was around 8:30 in the morning, and I saw that I had hundreds of messages on my phone, on WhatsApp, because that's how I communicate with my family. Text messages, about 130 notifications, plus Facebook and Instagram. And I thought, what happened?
Nelitza Tuarch is from Puerto Cabello, in the Venezuela's Carabobo state. She moved to Minnesota 9 years ago, and for her, the news opened a new perspective.
When I saw the news, the first thing I felt was truly relief, hope, happiness, and joy. And I said, God, this is finally what we've been waiting for such a long time. I'm honestly very, very happy about the possibility of returning to Venezuela and hugging my family again.
According to the United Nations Refugee Agency, nearly 7.9 million Venezuelans have left their country since early 2000. The Migration Policy Institute reports that about 80%, roughly 6.7 million people, settle in Latin America and the Caribbean. And now it's estimated that about 770,000 Venezuelan immigrants live in the United States.
For us, what happened this weekend represents the end of a very long and painful chapter. Venezuela has lived for more than 26 years under a system that limited freedoms, separated families, and pushed millions of people to emigrate.
From Minneapolis to Caracas, we say no to war. It's up to us.
So when we look at what happened, we cannot and we shouldn't ignore the history of the United States in Latin America, to be specific, and the impact of that influence, which at the end impact many of us because many people get displaced and some of us become some the refugees, some the immigrants as a result of those policies.
That's Francisco Segovia, executive director of COPAL, Comunidades Organizando el Poder y la Acción Latina, a member-based organization working to improve the quality of life of Latine families. Segovia, who is from El Salvador and came to the United States in the 1990s during his country's civil war, says that the U.S. actions in Latin America can have negative consequences.
So when I look at that, I look at here is history once again and impacting locals as well as promoting more migration, which is something that the United States doesn't want to see as well, as we have immigration raids happening here in the streets of Minnesota or Minneapolis.
He notes that Minnesota is home to a sizable Venezuelan community, many of them recent arrivals with temporary protection status.
The Trump administration ended that protection, which basically left thousands of Venezuelans without the work permit that would allow them to do work in the United States. So that is one huge impact in the Venezuelan community alone.
At a White House press conference, Secretary of State Marco Rubio defended the operations in Venezuela.
He is not the legitimate president of Venezuela. That's not just us saying it. The first Trump administration, the Biden administration, the second Trump administration, none of those three recognized him. He's not recognized by the European Union and multiple countries around the world.
For some Minnesotans, these actions align with what they want to see from the administration. Patrick Garofalo, A former Republican state representative in Minnesota says that the operations could strengthen the administration's immigration policies.
Well, many of the people from Venezuela who have fled to America did so because of the humanitarian crisis in their home country. And now with new leadership, market reforms, and getting Venezuela back on track, this will allow many of these individuals to return home.
Garofalo's belief these actions will not damage U.S. relationship in the region and argues that there was justifications for removing Venezuela's president.
Maduro have, again, they stole elections. They've ignored election results. They've put a tremendous amount of pressure on not only the United States, but also the migrations that are taking place in the neighboring countries. So in this situation, I think it's appropriate. I believe that's going to put Venezuela on the right track, and ultimately it'll be good for the entire Western Hemisphere.
But Segovia offers a different perspective.
The United States is basically destroying any relationships that can have with the continent, and that is going to last for very long. Lack of trust, because that has been so many years of U.S. interventions.
And for Nelitza and many Venezuelans in Minnesota, this moment represents both hope and uncertainty.
Many Venezuelans are grateful for the international support. We know that there are different opinions, of course, and we respect them greatly. But for those of us who have lived these realities up close, that is, Venezuelans, this moment represents something we have dreamed of for many decades, the possibility of rebuilding our country in freedom.
For North Star Stories, I'm Victor Palomino.
Invading another country and capturing its president has many implications that can stretch worldwide, even here in Minnesota. I'm now joined by Professor John Porton, a PhD in international relations from the University of California, San Diego. He also has 10 years of experience researching and teaching about civil war and political instability, and a law degree from the University of Minnesota. Professor Porton, welcome to North Star Stories.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. Let's just jump right in. What happens next in Venezuela?
I think there are a lot of individuals in Venezuela who will be interested in using the shakeup to emerge into a new place for their own power. And a lot of what's going to happen will depend upon what it is that the United States decides to do next in terms of its own demands of Venezuela or intention to support social or civil society change in Venezuela in the wake of this.
This is someone that's been in power for a while. Is there fear? Is there relief?
I mean, I think that it's important to say right out of the gate that the vast majority of the international community, most people in the United States, agree that Maduro's regime, the rule of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, is repressive. They've mismanaged the economy. There are criminal implications for the way that they've run the country, cooperations across criminal organizations that are bad. But of course, there is also fear, and there's also concern that very little will change. No president in an authoritarian regime is ever the full power. There's always a selectorate, a group of people who prefer to have the system that exists, and they are capable of mobilizing very quickly behind a new figurehead. Then very little is going to change in Venezuela over time. Really, only if something about having deposed Maduro leads to a real shift in who is in power in Venezuela are we going to see a change.
Would you say it's not only like a political shift, but also a cultural shift?
The fact that the vice president has been sworn in, even if she remains and she's known as something of a more liberal reformer than Maduro was, it's not clear how any of the incentives for any of the actors who are interested in opposing the Venezuelan Socialist Party have changed, what opening this provides to them. And some of that is going to be cultural. You're going to have people recognize that maybe Maduro and Chavez before him mismanaged the economy and haven't really been in it for average Venezuelans. You're going to have to force people to admit that the support they showed in public was maybe not wise and not constructive for the country. But you're also going to have a culture shift in the sense that people trust that opposition politics is safer, that it is constructive in the sense that you can build a future for your family and your community by opposing the Socialist Party's policies. And you have to have the Socialist Party start to accept that these challenges to their power are legitimate and need to be respected, and the authority of the state can pass between parties.
So then why should we, as Minnesotans, care? Help us understand.
I don't know that we have a specific reason other than the fact that we have a sizable Venezuelan community that includes a number of refugees from the Chavez and Maduro governments that live with us. But I think that what we want to be asking ourselves is whether the policy argument that we're seeing from our government is compelling to us morally or empirically. Do we think that what our government seems to be after here, and I think there's a lot of confusion about what that is right now, and it will only solidify what we're attempting to accomplish over the course of several weeks, is that something that we think we want for ourselves and for the world? And then secondly, have we embarked upon a policy program that's likely to deliver those results? And I've been skeptical in the interview so far, and I would highlight that I'm not sure what the plan is. And that's where my concern, I don't want to stamp on the hopes of the people from the first part of the segment who are just excited that a criminal is gone from their political system. But now comes the major question of what's next. And that's, I think, the harder question to answer by some distance.
For sure. Well, thank you so much, Professor Porton, for your time and your insights on this story. Really do appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up after the break, what you need to do to protect your livestock and other animals when we face dangerously cold temperatures this winter. You are listening to North Star Stories, produced by Ampers with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota.
Ampers is diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. We are an association of 17 independent community radio stations in Minnesota with over 300,000 listeners. We support our stations through revenue, training, and original news, arts, and cultural programs. Ampers programming is produced for and by the communities in our station's regions and aims to correct narratives about historically underrepresented groups. Check out what we're up to online at ampers.org, on Instagram, and Facebook.
While things are a little warmer at the moment, we've already seen dangerously cold temperatures this winter. When that happens, we need to protect more than just ourselves. Britt Ahmet finds out how to protect outdoor animals when winter is at its worst.
When cold weather hits, pet owners trot out the dog coats and booties and make sure the indoor-outdoor cats aren't out too long. But Minnesotans also take care of a wide variety of animals that live entirely outside. Horses, cattle, sheep, pigs, chickens, and they need special winter care too. Kathy Frederick is the owner of Gateway Meadows in Dayton, where she uses equine-assisted therapy to help veterans dealing with trauma. Even on the coldest mornings, she gets up early to take care of her horses.
The good news is the horses start preparing themselves as the weather changes. They really increase their coat. The hair comes in so thick. And as it starts getting colder, if they start shivering, we'll put coats on them.
She's had horses for many years, but boarded them elsewhere. Only recently has she begun keeping the horses on her land.
And it's very different when you have full accountability to take care of the horses. And I've learned a ton, but it's really a fair amount of work to make sure that you're not keeping a coat on and having them get too hot and start sweating, and then they could be cold at night.
Karen Johnson is an educator with the University of Minnesota Extension. She works with people like Kathy, as well as hobby farm owners, up to large dairy beef operations, to help them prepare for the long, cold months.
Step number one is really thinking about where your animals are going to live throughout winter. Do I have a place where they can get out of the wind? So that could be a shelter, barn, a windbreak. If you can figure out a way to get them a really deep, clean, dry place where they can bed down and nestle down into, especially when it gets cold.
Equally important is clean water and food.
Nutrition in general. We want to make sure that it has adequate body condition to be able to kind of weather winter, but also be able to maintain normal functions, right? And perhaps increasing that energy requirement that that animal needs ahead of winter could really be beneficial.
She says outdoor animals are very hardy if given the time to acclimate to the changing weather. But sometimes, for some animals, it just gets too cold.
So when the body gets stressed, we call that cold stress. The ones that get challenged the most tend to be your older animals, your younger animals, and the ones that may have been through a sickness. And in those cases, you need to spend more time with them, moving them inside an enclosed barn, really working with your nutritionist to maybe increase that energy available and just getting them out of that cold weather.
Another popular outdoor animal is the chicken. Having your own backyard flock can make a huge difference with egg shortages and increasing egg prices. Colleen Carlson, also an extension educator, is a fifth-generation poultry keeper.
And we have a long line of small flock backyard chickens, and my grandmother kept up to 1,000 chickens in the 1930s and the 1940s. So I like to bring that knowledge forward.
She helps new chicken owners get their coops ready for winter.
Prepare that coop for warmth. If you've got an 8x10 chicken coop, I suggest using the deep litter method, which is 6 to 10 inches of wood shavings on the bottom of the coop, and that provides that excellent insulation. It's nice if your coop has a south or east facing exposure, so when you open that door, they don't get a blast of cold weather.
Enough roosting space is also key.
So they have ample space that they can fluff up their feathers. Chickens are just like wild birds. They can poof up their feathers, and that creates warmth in their bodies.
Like with larger animals, a change in diet can help them better regulate their body temperature.
I would add some supplemental scratch grains, which is corn, oats, a mixture of different grains. Feed that to them about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That fills up their gizzard. So they generate heat in the night by grinding up that feed and digesting that food.
And most importantly, if you want eggs in winter, is to make sure the chickens get enough light.
There are some theories about to add supplemental light or to not add supplemental light. The purpose of the extended daylight is chickens typically will need 14 hours of daylight to enact their pituitary gland so that they release the egg. And a chicken will lay an egg on average every 26 hours. Chickens do keep very well in Minnesota, and they lay eggs year-round.
You can find out more about your outdoor animal care at extension.umn.edu. This is Britt Ahmet for North Star Stories.
Well, joining us now to talk a little more about this topic is Colleen Carlson from the University of Minnesota Extension and a fifth generation poultry keeper. Colleen, welcome to North Star Stories, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're a fifth generation poultry keeper, which is incredible. What winter care lessons have been passed down in your family that still hold true today?
We start with the breed. We want breeds that are standard breeds that are dual purpose. They do better in the winter. And then if you have some fancier breeds like the Polish chicken, you want to take some extra steps to make sure that they're comfortable in the winter and probably up their housing, making sure that you have an insulated coop, make sure that you can provide additional heat when the temperatures get below 32 degrees, and make sure that they have a good nutrition program moving into the winter.
Talk to me a little bit about yourself. You're the fifth generation poultry keeper. Why continue this generational tradition, if you will?
Well, so some of the things are, you know, the family tradition, but also the things that we've learned. And a couple of years ago, I did some work on one of our founders within the University of Minnesota Extension, Dr. Cora Cook. In the 1930s and 40s, she did a lot of work with poultry. And prior to that time, a lot of people just kept chickens because they wanted eggs. And it was part of the diversification of a farm. You had sheep, chickens, beef animals, and pigs. You had everything. Well, now we specialize. But the other thing that we've learned is that breeds of chickens do better when we manage them better. And so she talked about a better nutrition program, the housing, that if we bring them in from the outside from time to time and give them a formulated feed that includes all the components, the amino acids, the protein, the fiber, and also for egg-laying chickens, oyster shells. And we have increase the number of eggs that chickens can lay. In addition to that is better housing. When I teach poultry, we talk about how many square foot a chicken needs in the run and in the coop, how much space do they need in the roosting area. And prior to that, I mean, they might be in the back of the barn. They're laying their eggs all over the farm, wherever they find their little hidey hole. And so it makes it easier to find the eggs when they have a coop to go to. In the winter specifically, they're able to come inside. They have a nesting box. Chickens do share nesting boxes, but making sure that you have one nesting box per five chickens so there's not that competition.
So then what's the most common mistake you see new or backyard chicken owners make during a Minnesota winter?
Placement of their chicken coop and run. It's best to keep the chicken coop with a south or east facing exposure that gets the most sunlight, but also keeping the wind away from the coop and the run. So instead of putting the chicken coop out in the middle of the backyard, maybe think about how you can have a windbreak towards the north and protect some of those northwest winds from bearing down on your chicken coop. And the other thing, keeping the chickens at a comfortable temperature, they don't spend their energy staying warm. They can spend their energy producing eggs.
Well, Colleen, thank you for your time and your expertise.
Well, thank you.
Before we go, we want to tell you about some of the state's top attractions this month. The St. Paul Winter Carnival is coming up January 21st through February 1st. The World Snow Sculpting Championships will take place in Stillwater between January 13th and the 25th. The Sleigh and Cutter Festival in Waseca in northern Minnesota is going on all month. And don't miss Icebox Days and Freeze Your Gizzard Blizzard Run in International Falls. That's January 16th through the 25th. That will do it for this week's edition of North Star Stories, produced by Ampers with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota. If you missed any part of today's newscast, you can find this show and past episodes at ampers.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for listening, and be sure to join us next week when we'll have more stories and voices from the North Star State.
North Star Stories is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ampers.org.
Good boy.
So you got a new wind chime at home?
We got so many new wind chimes at home. This weekend we had a bunch of freezing rain that just stuck to everything, including all the trees. So that was the sound of this little leatherwood shrub that visually just looked like it was like shrink wrapped in ice. And then when you shook it, you know, the ice would break a little because it's rigid, even though the leatherwood is flexible. And so that was the sound of this poor ice-covered bush being shaken around a little bit.
Wow. And your dog.
Yeah.
Call it, your dog was and out there with you.
And my dog being a good boy.
Yeah. What's your dog's name?
His name is Drogo. He's a big, beefy sweetheart.
Drogo. Yeah. It's Charlie Mitchell. I'm Heidi Holton, and this is the Season Watch podcast, our first of 2026. And it's a place for the curious, filled with the delights of nature. And we're here to prove that even in ice storms and snow and blizzards, there are still things to be seeing out there.
Absolutely. I will say that everything being frozen in like a layer of ice does not look pleasant for the plants, and I'd rather not be out living in it, but it did make everything so beautiful.
I know. We had some issues with our tower for KEXE and KPXE with freezing stuff, so that was not fun for our engineer, Steve Noy. So, yeah, it is. It's a beautiful thing. Did you address how you were walking? Do you wear the yak tracks? Did you do any falls on the ice?
I've done some slips. I haven't done any falls. I should probably be wearing my yak tracks. Actually, in one of the last hurrahs of my career in outdoor retail, I went to a Salomon like training thing, and they gave us one free pair of shoes.
Oh.
Any of their shoes. And so the shoes that I chose were these like trail running shoes. I don't run on trails, but they're waterproof. They zip up the side, and then on the bottom, they have spikes on them.
Ooh.
And that's my go-to, it's slippery out pair of shoes.
The problem with that, like if you walked into KEXE wearing those shoes, we got wood floors, we got some...
You'd scratch them all up.
Yep. Yeah, so, but all good ideas, and I think really a good reminder, at the very least, shuffle anywhere you're going. And I never stopped talking about, like, there was like once or twice I've done it where I'm getting to KEXE really early in the morning, and I put that leg out the door when I pull up into the parking lot and don't realize how slippery what I'm stepping into is. And it's like, thank God I'm holding the door, but I'm, you know, a little too old to be doing the splits is what I'm saying. And it can pull something, you know? So it's just always paying attention to that. That's not, I guess it's nature, right? I didn't need to go into that, but I don't want people to have falls and have it affect them.
No. Yeah. And like putting out some sand or some gravel can also be, you know, nature's yak tracks. So you could put it on the ground instead of on your foot.
Right. Right. And limit your use of salt. Right. Because that may have some effects. But, you know, this is sort of interesting because, you know, we're in a new year here. And that means our students have been off, like we have been off on holiday. And so we had to kind of figure out what are we going to do this week because we didn't have any student reports. We had a great idea, didn't we?
We sure did. And that great idea was to talk to one of our partnering phonology teachers, Chad Kaditz. He's from Little Falls. He's a middle school science teacher. I think we emailed him the day before. And sure enough, there he was. So thank you, Chad. Short notice, but a great result.
It led us to some thinking of like how fun it would be to talk to other teachers in the year to come about what they're seeing in their students, because I think, you know, John talks about this a lot and you and I do as well of, yes, this is about learning about science and nature, but it's bigger.
Yep. Yeah. And I think especially that, you know, with all of these students we get to hear from that are watching the change in seasons, I also love hearing about the change in them and the change in all of us that are learning from them.
Yeah, let's listen to a little bit of how Chad approaches talking to kids about this or getting the ball rolling.
And there's just a special feeling you get when you recognize something.
Yes.
Which is why I always start, our first topic every year I've been doing this is always butter and eggs. It's everywhere and it's such an easy plant to identify. So I want the kids to get out on that first day and actually spot something on their own. And it's fun that, you know, they'll come back the next day all excited. But I've done all kinds of different, we used to just do the talks to start class. And for a couple of years, I tried doing journals, you know, where kids would draw pictures. Or my biggest thing is I didn't want it ever to become like work, like class work. It was just something we did for fun. You know, I think there's something to be said for seeing something and recognizing it, but there's also something to be said for kind of feeling like, yeah, whether it's just one topic or something, that you're maybe the smartest person in the room or you're a little expert on something, and that definitely keeps them locked in.
I'm so happy, like, to hear how involved his students are. And butter and eggs, it is a very common one to find. Have you seen it?
Yes.
Is that one you know?
That is one of the few that I know as well. And I think he's exactly right. There's something about naming.
You know,
if you feel a little bit, I mean, it gets into funny territory too, because apparently none of us want to say that we're an expert. And that's the whole point of phonology, is that we're always learning. But you do feel some pride, even if I'm not right, if I can come up with a name for something to say, this might be this, it triggered something in you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for a long time, probably until I moved back to Minnesota around 2021, I was kind of resistant to learning the names of things. Mm. I felt like, I think there was just so much ego in the people that I was working
sure.
with.
It's like that you didn't want to succumb to the man.
Yeah.
The man getting you down.
Absolutely. And it's like, why do I need to like go through a bunch of flashcards to enjoy and engage in nature? Like, y'all are gatekeeping.
Yes.
But then I started learning the names of a few things, and it does change your relationship.
Mm-hmm.
To recognize something and know its name. It's such a human, we love a label.
Yeah.
We love knowing the name of something. It makes it real in a way.
Right.
And like it makes it an individual. I'm reluctantly huge fan of learning the names of things.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think you said something interesting there about it's a relationship then. That's, again, getting to the bigger picture of things of in these times, having a relationship with nature is super helpful.
It really is.
So
in these times.
Yeah. So I don't want to get into it too much because I think everybody gets a little tired of hearing like, what's your New Year resolution and all of that kind of stuff. But I've tried to, just for myself, think about it more as set some goals maybe or that kind of thing. And I was thinking about it in terms of nature and season watch, that this might be an interesting time for us to do that or ask people if they're doing that, that you want to know two more plants this year, or you know of this trail that you've never gone to and you mean to go to it or something, that maybe we have some goals ahead.
Yeah, I like that. I think this is just me, but I find that like when I set goals in the new year, it has historically been a way of me telling myself that I'm not enough as I am.
Mm.
And that this year I'm going to be better because I'm going to be stronger and more productive and more the way the man wants me to be. And so I've kind of moved away from like the goal setting part of New Year's, but I do always look at the year ahead and still hope that things are different.
Yeah.
And one of the ways that I'm hoping this year will be different is that every summer, every spring and beginning of summer, I am out in the canoe like as much as I can. And then July and August, all of a sudden, you know, going down there, having to walk up the big hill back to the it's so hot outside, there are bugs, and I kind of lose the spark. And this year, I really don't want to do that. And I know what will help is if I set plans with other people to go canoeing. That's one of my wishes.
Really good point on how you balance that, how any of us balance that of not thinking of things as like a before and after picture, you know, that you're better, but that you want to add a few things to your life. But it's hard to get your brain around that kind of thing. I do want to say to you, those months that you haven't been as much in the canoe, remember the last few years, there's been a lot of smoke and different things going on in those months. So that may, you know, Canada fires coming through and stuff. And so sometimes there's some things, because I looked back on the summer and I thought, wow, I didn't get out. I like to have frequent pontoon rides with my friends, and we get out and swim and do this cool stuff. And I'm like, oh, we didn't do it very much. And I started to like tell myself, like, why didn't I do this? And I was like, oh, wait, we had a lot of extended smoke issues going on. So
that's a really good point.
See?
Also,
let yourself
off. You're such a compassionate human, and I love you so much. Thank you.
Well, we want to hear a little bit more of this conversation we had, right, with Chad Caddis from Little Falls Middle School. If you haven't yet done it and you're on Instagram, you're missing an opportunity to see cool stuff by checking out the Little Falls Phenology Instagram page. You should do that. And then let's take a listen to part of our conversation from this week.
I had an experience with one student who was notoriously bad as a student. But when we started talking phenology, he and his grandfather started keeping a journal of the birds that they were seeing. And suddenly this kid was, you know, he was top student in terms of identifying birds and just bird habitat, birds in general. He had that niche that was his, and it really made a difference in his life.
It's kind of funny. I had a student this year, a sixth grader, but I had her father however many years ago in class. And I remember he was just a kid that would always be able to answer questions about phenology. And we had made a joke in class, and I can still remember this, and it wasn't that big of a deal, but he was, you know, the king of phenology for the class. And she brought that up. I mean, that's been 20 years ago, and she brought it up in class. But my dad said that he was the phenology king. And I'm like, oh, that's crazy. That stuff sticks.
Yeah, that is amazing. I talk to a lot of teachers, and they tell me the same thing. When the kids come back and they run into them, and they're seniors in high school or they're out of school, and when they talk to them, they say, what do you remember? And they say, phenology.
Yeah.
It really makes a difference in a lot of their lives, which is very cool.
Point out, too, this is exciting because that was something, you know, I've been doing it for 30 years, and I kind of felt like phenology was a word that no one outside of our classroom really knew. And it's been exciting listening to, obviously, you know, the radio show and your reports in the morning, and then now the Season Watch podcast. And it's like there's a whole world of people out there that know about this. It's kind of like a secret club that all of a sudden you're, it's like when you go to college and realize that there's other people like you out there.
Yeah, very cool. You said you're going to be talking to them today about Cecropia moths, which is an interesting subject. What else do you have them sort of keyed up for January? So I'm going to be on the phenology show this morning. I'll be reviewing some of the events that I look for in January, some of the things that typically happen in January. What are some things that you will have the kids looking for this month?
I mean, birds are always a big topic. It's kind of an easy thing. One of the things I usually, this time of year too, try to get them paying more attention to our lichen, just because it's there's so many different, I think lichen are fascinating, but there's so many different types of lichen out there, and it's something that, you know, 99% of the population would walk past without even looking at or paying attention to. So little things like that, you know, it's obviously this time of year things slow down quite a bit. So, you know, all the different types of bracket fungi, which are something you can find in January and February. And it's always the leading up into the, you know, the spring when everything gets really exciting with the birds returning and the plant growth. So you have to kind of bide your time in January and February, but there's so many little things. So it's a lot of topics, things that aren't going to jump out at you, but there's so much you can still go out and discover this time of year.
This is when the king of phenology would come in and say, I saw. You'd be like, yeah, good. Nobody else has seen that, but that doesn't mean it's not happening. It just means that you're more observant, that you're paying more attention. Yeah.
We're talking with Chad Caddis this morning. He teaches phenology in Little Falls, and they've got a great Instagram page. You're going to want to follow Little Falls Phenology. Chad, I'm looking at how Jocelyn started off her Christmas morning. Tell us about this one. This is on your Instagram feed.
Yeah, and she's a kid that I get. I had her. She was a student last year, so she's at the high school this year. And last year, she's just, God, one of those great, any science teacher would just love to have a Jocelyn in their lives, because she's so inquisitive. And she's a kid that would, you know, I remember as a seventh grader is when she had found a bird that hit their window and she dissected it, and just one of those unique kids. And but she stopped in the last day of school before we left for Christmas break, stopped by to visit. And then the next morning, or whenever it was, Christmas morning, I guess, sent some videos. So she had gone out. I mean, I always make a big deal of it. I always try to feed birds, hand feed birds. I think it's kind of cool. And it's a little nerdy and dorky and the kids laugh at it, but I always show them videos when I do it. And then she had gone out Christmas morning and got a little chickadee to land on her hand. So sent me the video. I love sharing things like that. And it's cool to see, you know, kids that are no longer in your class are still connected to it.
It makes me so happy.
You know, this was from Tuesday morning this week, and I got to see two grown men cry because they feel so strongly about this, you know?
Yep. I was wondering whether that was John choking up a bit.
Mm-hmm. And Chad, mm-hmm. too, when he talked about the student. Yeah. I think it's such a great thing. I don't know if I ever look at lichen. He talked about that. That's a good thing this time of year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it lichens hard to see with the snow?
Well, they're up on trees.
Okay.
They're on. Okay. Lichens are one of those things where once you start seeing them, you mm-hmm. see them everywhere, okay. particularly in northern Minnesota because your air quality is so good. Lichens are profuse up there, and the number of species is incredible. If you end up getting into lichens, there's a phenomenal field guide written by Joe Wileski. He's one of the naturalists at Wolf Ridge. And it's a really wonderful guide to some of the more common lichens, especially in the North Woods. But they're so colorful, especially if you are able to like bring along like a little jeweler's loop or hand lens, or even if you have like one of the newer iPhones that has a really good macro lens.
Okay.
They're so intricate and fascinating. You know, they're the big green ones that we often see on the side of trees. They're called like a green shield lichen. Then they're like brown shield lichens. My favorite ones are these ones that they look very nondescript, like a drab gray color in daylight. If you go out at night with a UV light, they glow just this super intense gold.
Wow. Well, you've inspired me, and of course, Chad Caddett's there, but I'm going to be heading out into the woods on our trails to ski, I think, later today. I'm going to look. I'm going to see what I see, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Instead of worrying, I mean, the trail is a little icy, so even though we have barely any incline, mm-hmm. I'm definitely being a little more careful going down the small little hills and stuff like that. But it's the nice thing of when we do get the ice with trails, like how it's fun. It's very fun when they kind of get iced over, you know? But scary. That's why I don't generally go.
I mean, that's the adrenaline rush, right?
I know. Yeah. And that might be a good, I generally just go on. There's just always things to see because we don't have as much light this time of year. I don't always have time to like go find a trail or that kind of thing. And I'm a little, mm-hmm. I've only retaken up cross country skiing in the last 3 years or so. So I'm a little less confident on going to like some big hills. There's the Legion Trails here in Grand Rapids. It's right behind the high school. It's a big hills and they're lit up all night and mm-hmm. they're very cool, but I've walked them in the off season and they're great, but I think that's all I can handle for the moment.
I've been a little shy on the skiing. The last time I went with my wife, Haley, and she's a great snowboarder, but relatively new to cross-country skiing. And she fell, and the way that she fell was her ski was like upturned on its side, and she fell directly with her tailbone onto the ski in this pretty hard-packed snow, broke her tailbone. And that took months to heal.
Wait a minute.
And
we're supposed
now
to.
Now I'm always like a little nervous about.
We're supposed to inspire people to get outside. Here I was talking about shuffling and ice.
Telling terror stories.
I know. But you just got to be, that's part of it. You just got to be a little bit watchful and know where you're mm-hmm. going. John Latimer this week on his phenology report also gave us some ideas about this time of year and what to be looking for.
Just a couple of notes about chickadees because they kind of interest me. And this time of year, they're going to be starting to sing. They have done recent research on the songs of the chickadees, they found out that both male and female chickadees sing the Phoebe song, and that the chickadees can recognize the sex of the bird singing by the type of song that they sing. For me, not so much, but for the chickadees, yes, they can. Chickadees are really interesting little birds. You wonder how they can get through the winter. They cache seeds. They can remember their caches up to 28 days. The part of the brain that is spatial and focuses on memory is the hippocampus, and it is at its largest size in October. And by February, as it begins to exhaust its caches, the hippocampus starts to shrink. And come February, it is pretty small. So even though they are developing this ability to remember where they've hidden things, towards February, it gets a little bit less and less. And probably it's because they've exhausted most of their hiding places. Having feeders doubles the chance of a chickadee's survival. Just having that regular source of food for them can keep a lot of chickadees alive that would otherwise die. Chickadees are hierarchical. That means that there is a top dog in the flock, and that top dog is going to appropriate all of the food that it wants and needs before it's going to allow any of its subservient flock members to eat. So feeding at a bird feeder sort of eliminates that threat to the lesser birds, those of lesser significance in the flock. So they are right now probably just beginning to wake up. They roost usually singly, which is kind of hard to believe because they're so tiny, and yet usually in some thick brush or maybe in a cavity. But sometimes they'll roost in groups, but mostly they roost singly. They can go into torpor. They can lower their body temperature up to 12 degrees centigrade, which is an incredible, you know, that's like 20 degrees Fahrenheit. So they can drop their body temperature down. It will keep them alive in very cold temperatures by just kind of going into this torpor and waking up from it to survive in the mornings.
Torpor.
Torpor. That's one of our words, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Man, the great facts about chickadees there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I immediately got very curious, and you might have heard me like trying to click very quietly.
Yeah, what did it make you think about or want to know more about?
Well, what I was thinking about is in terms of, you know, how we've been talking about winter as like power saving mode time, mm-hmm. or like a battery saver or whatever. The brain is a very energy hungry organ. And so, for instance, shrews shrink their brains like by I think a third, it might be two thirds over the winter, just because they don't want to have to feed all that energy into their brain. And for chickadees, it's the opposite, where because their brain is so important to finding the energy that they need, it's actually larger in the winter. So I just thought that was really interesting. I was also struck by their memory is just incredible. That they can stash so many seeds and find them a month later or even longer. And so I went onto birdsoftheworld.org. It's run through the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Really amazing compendiums for each species of like all of the science kind of behind them. And chickadees that are further north have larger hippocampi compared to chickadees in southern latitudes.
Hmm.
So even though it's more energy expensive, it clearly is an adaptive like benefit for them to have that bigger brain all winter.
Wow.
Be able to find all that food.
Time to extrapolate. I was trying to extrapolate that to myself, you know, get a little selfish here, but I'm like, okay, so I'm still in torpor, right? It's winter. I can still you know, in the pajama pants the minute you get home, and relaxation, quieter mode of winter time in Minnesota.
Absolutely. And like even chickadees have to enter torpor.
Yeah.
Definitely balancing that high brain with a lot of sleepy time.
If you are like Charlie and some of what you heard today made you curious or you want to add to this conversation, you are always invited to do so. We hear from lots of people and we have a method of doing that through SpeakPipe where you can leave us a voice memo. You'll find that on our page at kexe.org. Look for Season Watch and then you can also see it in the show notes of the podcast. So next week, back to students, no doubt, don't you think?
Back to students. I believe we'll be hearing from Pam Perry.
Oh,
I wonder
right.
if Pam will be able to tell us her qualifications for who's a birder. So I'm still thinking about
it. Yeah, she seems like, I think everybody's a little in awe of Pam. And so I think you might mm-hmm. think that she's got some real qualifications, but I bet she's a little more yeah. open than I would assume. But we shall see. That's Charlie Mitchell. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Season Watch podcast from KAXE.
And to bring us out today, we have the Chickadees Spring Song, sometimes known as the Phoebe call or the cheeseburger call. And this is a recording that I got from Zeno Canto by Jonathan Jongsma.
Did I hear a little woodpecker in there too? Sure mm-hmm. sounded like it.
Sure did. Good ear.
All right. That's yep. the chickadee. Thanks, Charlie. We'll check in next week.
Great. Thank you, Heidi.
I'm Jennifer Barr, a producer here at KAXE. One of the things I do is write public service announcements for our hosts to read on air. We love sharing information about all the things that happen throughout our region, things that make northern Minnesota a great place to live. From Bagley to Virginia, from Brainerd to Big Fork, we want to hear from you. Let us know about events happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. Again, that's psa@kaxe.org. Send us info at least 2 weeks in advance of your event. Thanks for helping us build community in northern Minnesota.